Hello, and thank you for joining us for the Willkommen webinar. Today we will be talking about best practices, and this is actually part two of our series. And we will be focusing mainly on retail and higher ed. I'm Sarah Bemperat with Willkommen, and we'll just do some housekeeping and then get the webinar started. So in case you do have any questions, you can use the Q&A section to submit those questions or your comments to the panelists, and we'll try to get to those questions throughout the session. And for the best webinar experience, we recommend that you log out of any other applications that are currently running. If you run into any technical issues, you can contact me at sbemperat@willkommen.com. And we will also be recording the session, and the recording will be available within the next few days. The session is sponsored by PlanOn and Sky Foundry, and we'll learn more about these companies throughout the session. And with that, I'd like to introduce you to Paul. Paul Maxwell has deep experience in building controls, commissioning, and intelligent buildings implementation. As a senior intelligent building consultant at Newcomb & Boyd, he is eager to apply his experience as an owner to help others on the path of intelligent buildings and successful operation technology projects. Paul, thank you so much for moderating today's session. I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, Sarah. I'd like to say good morning to the West Coast folks, good afternoon to the East Coast folks, and good evening to the global folks. So let's start by this. What a difference a year has made, a little over a year has made, on how smart technology has evolved. A few years ago, you talked about bringing in smart technology into a workplace or higher ed facility or retail establishment. A lot of people were standoffish about it. They were still trying to evaluate and see if it is worth the investment. What's interesting now is COVID hit and everybody is scrambling to see how they can deploy technology that'll monitor their spaces, keep their employees healthy, keep their customers healthy, and bring value to the business as well. So today we are going to touch on many of those topics, anywhere from how do we evaluate technology, what are some of the technologies deployed, what are the challenges to implement and adapt to that technology, and bringing in the IT infrastructure to support that and maintaining a secure environment as well. So today we have various panelists with different points of view on the technology side, and it's going to be very interesting to hear what they have to say. I can just say from my personal experience, you know, we have looked at technology, we evaluate it every day. We found some areas that really have been well adapted. We find areas in indoor air quality for the environment that the people are actually occupying, spatial utilization of where people are located at, how they're evolving around in the space and maintaining social distancing and practicing a safe workplace environment. What will be interesting is this technology really is going to come to full play as people return back to work. And as we have seen in a lot of surveys and a lot of client discussions and customer discussions, we find that there's a huge swing towards going to a hybrid environment where people will not be in the office every day or on campus every day, but partially, and this brings this whole new set of challenges. So I'm not going to spend too much more time on that point. I'm going to let some of our panelists discuss their point of view and what they are working on and where the technology is going to adapt into their environment and move forward with that discussion. So the first thing I would like to do is introduce Ryan Knutson from Maestricht, and he is going to have a discussion on energy management and their operations. Ryan, I want to bring the bio on for you. Sorry about that, apologize. Ryan Knutson is the AVP for Operations Energy Management at Maestricht, where he is responsible for the development, execution, and operations for all capital expense, energy, and smart building projects, including national program vendor management. Ryan, I'll hand it off to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. Good morning, everyone. As Paul said, I'm Ryan Knudsen, AVP for Macerich. Macerich is a REIT that specializes in Class A shopping centers in densely populated markets. We currently own and operate about 50 million square feet of real estate across 46 regional centers. Today, I'm going to be highlighting one of our specific centers where we have invested quite a bit in both hard energy assets and technology to really come up with some innovative ways of tackling some traditional energy expense demand management challenges that owner-operators experience. Quickly, some facts about Danbury, the case study. Danbury Fair Mall is located in Danbury, Connecticut. It is a traditional enclosed shopping center that was opened in 1984. It's two levels and about approximately 1.3 million square feet. Some interesting facts technically about the building. There is a central plant that provides chilled water to just the first or lower level. And then the second level consists of packaged RTUs. Moving on from just some baselines, at Danbury Fair, we've invested quite heavily in both on-site generation, hard energy assets, as well as traditional mechanical refreshes. What we're showing here is kind of our base case that we were looking at about a year, 2 years ago, actually now, in 2019, when we first launched this program. And as you can see, this is our traditional kind of what we refer to in California as the duckbill curve, where during the middle of the day, where those rates and energy usage were typically the highest, we're now seeing that being offset quite significantly by our on-site generation assets, our solar and our fuel cells. However, as the day progresses and those solar panels stop producing and lights kick on and some things that we typically didn't see as a demand driver, are now setting our peaks. So how do we attack that? Well, we attack that by leveraging technology through fault detection diagnostics to try and find and optimize our mechanical systems, but then also to now leverage those same tools for automated demand management. So we're leveraging our BMS and our deep analytics to find areas of efficiency to reduce our demand. So how do we do that? We do that by setting a peak threshold that, based on historical data, we believe that we can achieve. And we then allow the system to traverse all approximately 250 mechanical devices through fan coil units and HVAC to slowly and incrementally change set points automatically without any human intervention to maintain both comfort and that demand. And as you can see, between the base case and the current case, we've been able to reduce our load by about 200 kW on a given day. These 2 days are about a month apart because it took a month to implement and trend. However, they're both in the summertime. The base case was in July. The automated demand management was in August. And as you can see, we were able to achieve a peak demand reduction of 200 kW, which we estimate is the equivalent of about $4,000. And this to us represents simply the floor. We are just now on our journey for what I kind of internally refer to as fault to resolution or automated demand limiting software and systems, but we believe that as the system matures and as the data set matures, we're gonna see more and more efficiencies being eked out of that building, especially as we transition into winter in Connecticut, which will represent some heating load reductions that we think we'll see even better. The other thing I wanted to address is we talked about the central plant. As we start to make changes to the air side of the building, we're actually seeing our decreased load as viewed by the chill water plant, and the chill water plant is starting to recognize even greater savings. So it's a really great case study in how building a building correctly and leveraging interoperability, we're able to really start to see these systems play together in a very interesting way, where we don't have to directly touch the central plant through our deep analytics and machine learning. We can let the building react naturally to it. And so again, that represents why we believe that the estimated $4,000 a month is a base case or a floor, and can only improve from there. So how did we get here? Well, that's what I would like to talk to today. So the journey for Danbury is about 10 years long, and it started in 2011 when we did a cooling tower replacement and we integrated our utility meters at the site. And that was it. We just wanted to tap our meters and see how much energy we were using and when we were using it. And from there, we started to put together some retro commissioning plans, some internal optimization, but leveraging the existing systems. We hadn't really retrofitted anything beyond just the cooling towers, which were mechanically failing and just needed to refresh. But then over the next 5 years, we started to get into a refresh cycle on just the mechanical systems, air handlers and rooftop units. But because we had tapped our meters, we were able to articulate to our internal stakeholders and external partners that the mechanical retrofits were realizing savings that we were saying could potentially happen. And we were able to prove that out through hard data. And so that started to generate more and more interest in energy assets at Danbury. So that gets us to 2015, where we built out a rooftop solar installation across the entire building and a hydrogen fuel cell installation. So now we're getting into these hard energy assets, on-site generation, renewable type activities. But again, we had tapped our meters. So, you know, going to our CFO and our executive team and saying these things are going to save X, we were able to quickly and almost in near real time prove out these things are saving X. And again, that just built that momentum, kept the interest going. To 2016, we did a full central plant modernization where we replaced all of the mechanical equipment in the plant, chillers, pumps, motors, everything. And then that led into, obviously, we need to do the controls. And so we completely retrofitted the controls off of pneumatics, actually, to DDC, those kinds of traditional technological advancements that we all tend to talk about. But what's important here is we didn't just start off at, we're going to do, you know, artificial intelligence at Danbury Fair. We started very incrementally, and we kept going back to, frankly, the utility meter integration. And anytime an internal stakeholder said, well, are we really seeing the ROI that we thought we were going to see? We have the data to accurately point to and say, absolutely, yes. Here's our base case before we did the project. Here's the base case now. And really continue to generate that interest in the hard energy asset investment. And that is the key, is continuing the stakeholder engagement through data, through the technology, being able to show what that investment has given us. The last kind of major investment we did was in 2018, where we continued our on-site generation strategy and built out a carport solar installation. And finally, to 2021, really it should have been 2019, but 2021, we're able to implement this artificial intelligence enabled automated demand management, which builds upon every step that we've done. I would tell you from my perspective, the savings that we showed in the previous slide of potentially $4,000 a month, it's a base case because all of these systems are ready to react to something as advanced as the on-point automated demand management. The system is traversing 200 units, but it can because we have a BACnet system and they're all talking to each other in real time, that we're able to visualize all of this because we've leveraged tagging conventions and haystack conventions. So we're leveraging all of these tools that we collectively as a group continue to talk about. And here's how you can build slowly to something that is quite advanced you're able to allow the operator to take a step back from the system, let the system do what it does best without having to actually touch everything, and allow the building to start to naturally react to small incremental changes throughout the day. And with that, I appreciate the opportunity, and I'll turn it back over to you, Paul.
Thanks, Ryan. Great information. So a couple questions I'd like to ask you. One, you talked about your metering infrastructure. You tapped in, obviously, to the utility meters. How deep did you go with your metering strategy? If you can
Great
give
question.
Some
yeah.
highlights on that.
Yeah. So that's been an evolution as we've gone on. We started at just the utility level. And just we have bills coming in. We wanted to monitor what we were paying out. We wanted to be able to compare and contrast. But as we started implementing these hard energy assets, the on-site solar, the fuel cells, we've tapped those as well. And we've brought those into our building management system. So that way we are able to show in real time as the solar starts to go down, the utilities usage starts to go up. We have looked at kind of sub-metering at the device level. However, right now, we're still kind of at that aggregate building load level.
Very good. One other question I have, you talked about renewable energies. What are some of the cost and return on investment on there?
Right. So it all depends on the type of system. I can tell you that rooftop solar is significantly cheaper by kW than a fuel cell. I can tell you that carport solar is significantly more than a rooftop solar. So in order of magnitude, you're probably looking at rooftop solar as the least first cost down to then next carport, then fuel cell. But it really is dependent upon the region that you're in, the incentives that you can get. In Danbury specifically, the reason that we're so heavy on our on-site generation is the local utility has some very lucrative incentive programs, as well as we're able to compete in the REC market. So we offload a lot of our solar back to the grid. That's why if you look at that graph, there's sometimes during the day that we're using grid power and we're not trying to completely offset our load because we're pushing energy back to the grid. That was by design because the ZREC market in Danbury, Connecticut is so lucrative that it just financially makes more sense. Generally speaking, we look at things on a 10-year net present value, and we're seeing, generally speaking, about a 15 to 18% return given the market fluctuation on our hard energy assets. But that's them insulated on themselves. As we start to introduce, you know, leveraging the solar production to offset HVAC usage, right? And, you know, leveraging the fuel cell, not to ramp up or ramp down, but to really kind of understand when is the best time to turn things on and off, that value proposition only increases.
Very good. So, Ryan, thank you for your time. I think we're going to be at the next panelist on, and I would like to bring on the next panelist. I'd like to introduce Rick Heidrich. He's the AVB of Operations and Energy Management, or I'm sorry, VP Strategy and Innovation, George Brown College. Rick oversees strategic planning and partnership development to ensure George Brown College remains well positioned to evolve and adapt for the digital and rapidly changing future. Rick, I'll turn it over to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Paul. A pleasure to be here. A little bit jealous when I hear Ryan speak about all the great initiatives that they're doing there. And I'll have about 8 minutes to share that we're not quite there yet, but certainly at the cusp of changing things up in our organization. In addition to my role at George Brown College, I'm also an industry fellow at Intelligent Buildings, kind of building on my passion of the coming together of technology and buildings and how we can start to make better spaces. And that's certainly a focus of my role at the college as well. Very briefly about us, the institution, we're a Toronto-based post-secondary education institution servicing about 30,000 students each year with about 4,000 employees, and then another about 60 or 70,000 continuing education students, often in the evenings and weekends. And we service this population over three campuses in Toronto, about 2 million square feet across 20 buildings. And the ages of the buildings range between about 80 years old and 2 years old. As a post-secondary and a public sector institution, we recognize, even before COVID, a bunch of key things. Of course, being in downtown Toronto space comes at a premium. We are a vertical campus, don't have the land to expand as we probably would want to or should. And frankly, as space comes at a premium, it's hard to afford and to reimagine within the footprint that we have. We also have kind of before COVID moved into a new direction and start to reimagine us as an institution with a vision for 2030. And we do know that we need to have spaces, both physical and virtual, that kind of grow with us and kind of meet the needs of our teaching and learning experiences. And as such, we have identified that our infrastructure conversation must be digital and physical. And to the last point here, that therefore we've put together IT and facilities in one team to really take advantage of both teams in a smarter and in a better way to maximize the value of the assets that we have. Frankly, we also teach IT and construction and architecture and project management. So what we do believe is we need to practice what we preach, and offer our students almost a living lab and start to demonstrate what the future of built environment could and should look like. Now, COVID, of course, completely changed everything for everybody and for us as well. Post-COVID will not be the same as pre-COVID. Like everybody else, we've moved towards working from home and now coming back to campus in a more hybrid setting. We're very much focused on the evolution of online education. How do we get rid of lecture halls? How do we move lecture-based education and training more to online or augmented settings or hybrid settings, and really focus on the hands-on learning spaces? We are looking at our built environment to implement sensors to manage the points that you made, Paul, at your introduction, to manage occupancy, to better track and trace our population. And frankly, the community around us, and also start to look at how we can take better advantage of building automation that includes managing and optimizing and monitoring, which is not something we did before, our air quality in better ways. And it goes from sensors and building automation all the way to starting to think about how do we use service robots to support our students better, to maybe even support our classes. And we think about all those things, the new future of work, new space, new office environments, using sensors and thinking about automation. I would almost say those are the easy parts. The biggest challenge we are bumping into is, of course, the massive culture shift and change that comes with this. Being a post-secondary or a government organization, having all our staff and workforce be unionized, having students coming from all over the world, 30% of our students are international. We're looking at constant ways to kind of co-create and work with our community to start to think and imagine how we use space at the intersection of IT and real estate. We have a very unique opportunity, and that is a brand new building we're building. It's about 10% of our footprint. It will be construction started 2 weeks ago. It will be a tall wood project, about 100, but almost a little bit shy of 200,000 square feet. Because of the way we are using wood and our architect has designed the building, we're looking at natural elements to really create a net zero energy building with solar chimneys and starting to look at more natural ventilation air flows. We need to think of a space that is highly flexible, that can really grow with us and be responsive to the needs that we have. And then we believe we can do that better if our building is, call it smart, and has networked systems and where we can be more data driven. This will be quite a leap forward for us, because I mentioned we have 20 other buildings that are of all different makes and sizes, and where we have not really had a chance to really converge and centralize all our capabilities. In addition to COVID, we had the good fun, I guess, to be a victim of a cyber attack earlier this summer. As a result, we've also learned again how to start to segregate and integrate building systems on our infrastructure and networks, because for months we've been really focused on getting our learning systems and our student focus systems to get back online and in a more safe way. But as a result, we are still in some cases not able to access our remote building automation systems. So it's certainly a wake-up call on starting to think differently on how to use technology and how to integrate our systems to create environments that can outlast any cyber or other challenges. Now, if it is this brand new building or one of the many other capital projects we have on site, even to this date, though, we still see language like this show up in our specification language. And, you know, you can read this asking for Microsoft NT servers and my Windows 2000 browsers and CDs for backup. And so it's so critical when we do a project, a capital project to renovation, that we really focus and pay attention to these details, because it's stuff like this that still get baked otherwise into what we support and maintain that's going to prevent us from really creating the open data centered environments. And so for this case, we had engaged Intelligent Buildings to help us find those and clean those things up and work with our engineering community to create not only the Arbor to be much more future ready, but also to implement some standards and ways of thinking for us and our community about how we think about our capital projects and our spaces. And so the key comes back to this change management and culture change. And this, we need to start to, being in education, we of course got to draw from Socrates, where the secret of all this change is not to focus or fighting the old, but really kind of building the new. And we have a huge opportunity. And as they say, never look never waste a good crisis, where between COVID, the malware we were dealing with, and then the opportunity to build a new building, to really elevate the standard and make our campus much more technology enabled for our own benefit, as well as again, for our students to see where this world is going. Yeah, there you are, Paul. I'll pause.
Hi, Rick. I'm back. Very interesting perspective. I have a few questions I would like to ask. Obviously, you've looked at technology. What are some of the technologies that seem to make the most sense for you to bring into your campus with a return on investment that makes sense?
A low-hanging fruit, and again, some of the call may say, well, why didn't you do that a long time ago? Because some of this is not rocket science, is occupancy sensing and utilization tracking. Mm-hmm. We have historically tracked the utilization of our classroom and our spaces through scheduling tools, and it's one thing to schedule something, it's another thing to actually occupy the spaces, and do we have the right sizes and classroom occupancy? We look at our scheduling tools and say, well, we're like 93% occupied all the time. Therefore, we must have more space. But when you walk around, you realize, well, maybe we're not, because not every class may run the way it was intended. So starting to look at occupancy and real-time tracking so we can in real time optimize our scheduling and really start to maximize the limited footprint that we have. We're one of those colleges in Canada with the smallest footprint per student because we're so interlocked into downtown and don't have the room to build and expand, that we need to draw value out of every square foot we have. And so occupancy sensing and then using automation to kind of optimize utilization, huge one. Second one, which was not really kind of a high priority initially, but that's now air quality. We're getting students to come back on campus and faculty and staff wondering, is the air that I breathe healthy? And we have buildings that are 80 years old that don't have the most innovative equipment. So beginning of the pandemic, we did a lot of manual testing and validating. And of course, now as we start to move back, starting to use the technology to give us more real-time information about the quality of the air, and then dictate or instruct our systems to optimize where possible. But we have still a long way to go, and I'd say these are probably two of the key areas where we can make and are making now the quickest inroads.
Very good. So you mentioned also, you know, these technologies help enable energy reduction in your facilities as well. Have you seen a change in your energy cost to operate your facility on a monthly basis?
We have, although again, the last 2 years have been a little bit misleading because we were closed so much. We just shut everything down that we could. Again, some of our newer buildings where we have more control, more visibility, we see a substantial improvement in energy consumption and energy cost per square foot, where we have more, dated or legacy systems, and particularly now not even have access. We still see a lot of space for us as we do capital projects and renewal projects to focus on not just replace lights like for like or replace systems like for like, but take kind of the smart approach to it so that we will gain more insight and more control over our space and start to add more analytics and automated responses to how the buildings are being used throughout the week, and then what the users kind of expect, and create better environmental conditions. And we are confident, based on the few buildings that where we have now implemented this, the newer buildings, that we will see further improvement. And we look forward to those savings because every penny counts. And with about $100 million backlog of construction work on our and upgrades to our site, we are destined to take every penny we can save and pour back into optimizing our facilities.
That's a great story, Rick. And with that, I am going to thank you for the presentation, and we will see you at the end when we summarize things. I'd like to take a break here for a minute and introduce our video from PlanOn, and then we will bring on our next speaker. Thank you. I'm back. Sorry, I apologize. I think I was muted when I was announcing the video. So I'd like to introduce our next panelist, Shuli Steele. She is the Director of Higher Education Practice at PlanOn. Shuli guides clients through portfolio planning and design, combining rigorous quantitative data analysis, quantitative client input. She is a globally recognized higher ed expert with deep bench knowledge in campus planning, built environment technologies, and change management methodologies. So I'd like to introduce Shuli. It's all yours, Shuli. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks very much, and welcome, everybody. As you mentioned, I am with PlanOn. There we go. Okay. I'm with PlanOn, and I have a strong background in higher education, consulting there for well over a decade. And we've seen some tremendous trends and advancements in higher education. And if there is a silver lining in the pandemic, what we're seeing in particular in higher education is a reduction in silos, breaking down those silos. It is common practice in the past in higher education for divisions and departments to make more isolated decisions. But the pandemic has essentially required these various areas to start to talk more closely with each other. So we're seeing better communication, better information sharing within departments. One of the keys that we've also noticed when working with higher education is both a micro and a macro level approach to smart buildings, smart technologies and spaces. Some of our clients are starting with the smart space at a micro level, looking at individual rooms, looking at technologies that can be brought in to measure those spaces and how to expand that across the campus. Others are starting to look at the macro level, the building itself, introducing technologies at a building level and starting to assess the information that is collected, the value of that, and then proliferating that throughout the campus. One of the key trends we found is that there's greater synergy needed across all these sources. So we heard previously the notion of pulling together space and technology, and we're really starting to see synergy between four key resources, and that is people, information, technology, and place. When scheduling a particular place, for example, a meeting room, not only are we looking at the people that are being brought into the place, but what sorts of technology needs to be there, what sorts of information needs to be provided during that time, so that as we start to expand to the seamless workplace, how do the people then return to remote work, to remote research, and still bring the information and the results of those conversations with them? Another key area that we also look at is KPIs. The key performance indicators in the past, in particular in higher education, have been about revenue, profits, or reductions. For example, in ticketing or in services required to maintain a campus. What we're starting to see is an expansion in those KPIs. What is the value of the Internet of Things? What is the value of this information that we're collecting? And if we can prove the value of the data collection, then we can start to apply it. We can start to look at prototyping different spaces to see what is an ideal for classroom, for example, office space, research spaces, community engagement spaces, and we can proctor those spaces in different ways. We've heard Rachel mention gate counts or badging or movement of people within spaces, perhaps with cameras or with geofencing. If we're starting to look at the value of proctoring these spaces, in other words, what's the result of knowing when a space has actually been used in a certain way, then we can start to demonstrate the success of the technologies, and then how it betters the student experience, the faculty, and the community experience at campus. I think this is really the key piece. We're designing a digital print or digital representations of our campuses. And as we advance that notion, we are starting to see that we can create better experiences by testing and applying certain ideas. We're modeling the smart technologies for those better decisions. So for example, Revit 2021, the generative tool. We can look at how a 6-foot distance between students would be embodied in the existing classroom makeup. We can start to look at assembly spaces and meeting spaces and what we would need to do if the health directives changed. If we wanted to go down to the 3-foot distancing, what does that do to impact the student experience? One thing that we've seen in the past is a tremendous amount of research on the neuroscience of learning. If the students have 9 NASF versus 20 NASF, how does that impact their learning and their retention? Again, a silver lining is that we started to expand students and less distance between them, and they had more peer interaction, we see higher retention. So we start to look at the theories that have been out there and how those are applying then to the physical spaces and the benefits to the student, faculty, staff, and the community experience. One other last note, I believe it's been about in the past 5 or 6 years, we have seen 9 times more information collected than in recorded history. The question now is what do we do with that information and how do we have it?
Very interesting, Julie. Have a couple questions for you. One of the things that concerns everybody is the data security. What issues are you seeing and what potential concerns do you have to address for those issues?
Yeah, great question. So it really, it comes in at several levels. On the physical security, we want to be certain that whatever data we are collecting on the individual, on the human condition and the human experience, is well secured and protected. And that's why I think many institutions are looking at prototyping first. We're also seeing that in the IT departments themselves, working more closely with facilities and other areas, they're finding that there's a fair number of redundancies in the applications that they've been hosting in the past. Again, in the traditional siloed experience, they may have multiple applications for certain activities. They're starting to see a reduction in those applications and more of a unified approach that allows them to advance security and authority on fewer applications, fewer pieces of software, and that's helping them.
Very good. One more quick question. Data quality and currency for future contagions are important in today's society. What do you see as the best way to achieve those?
Yeah. Again, I mentioned briefly the Revit generative design. It gives us the opportunity with the BIM model to say what if, to pose those what if. If, for example, we have a certain distance between students or people within a room, what does that look like? And due to having those multiple designs pre-modeled, then as we're bringing students in by term or as information changes, we can very quickly and dynamically respond to their needs and keep a safe environment for them. We can also look at planning for future in our research spaces. We might have multiple people buying mass spectrometers, purchasing CSF that the individuals may not, that are working on individual grant and research data. We're starting to see more synergy there. So as we're looking at being more responsive to contagions, again, we're aggregating information, facilities, and resources to be a little bit more intelligent about the decisions that we make.
Very, very interesting information. Thank you, Julie. I want to get us moving on to our next video. But before we do that, I just want to let everybody in the audience know, I know we have some questions coming in. We are going to have question and answer sessions at the end, so I will make sure we address those when we get to the end of the presentations. So the next video will be from Sky Foundry.
SkySpark is an analytics platform that automatically analyzes data from automation systems, meters, sensors, and other smart devices in order to identify issues, faults, trends, correlations, and opportunities for operational improvements and cost reduction. SkySpark works with data of all types, whether it be live data from automation systems, smart meters, web services, or historical data from CSV files and databases. SkySpark can also be used in a wide variety of applications, including energy and resource management and reporting, monitoring-based commissioning, equipment fault detection, energy analysis, load profiling, facility benchmarking, and asset performance tracking. Visit skyfoundry.com today and start finding what matters.
Hello, everyone. I would like to introduce our next panelist. Our next panelist is Paul Bergquist from Business Development at Sky Foundry. Paul has over 20 years of experience in building automation and energy management. In his senior role in business development at Sky Foundry, he helps owners take advantage of advanced operational analytics to create truly intelligent buildings. Welcome, Paul.
Oh, hello, and thank you. Thank you, Paul, and thanks to the RealCon team for the opportunity to speak to you today. So today we're briefly going to discuss the role of analytics and what users can expect to achieve across all different types of facilities. Sorry, I went too far there. Let me back up. So what is the role of analytics for people that might be coming to this session today that are, you know, considering getting involved in something like this? You know, one of the key points is that we have all these sensors, we have all these equipment systems, we have new IoT devices throughout all of our facilities, and the data they produce have value, right? And we can connect to that data. Sometimes connecting to that data is hard, and sometimes it is much easier. But really connecting to the data and getting access to it is really just the first step in what we describe as the analytics journey. And as Ryan rightly described it, it really is a journey. You know, the plan to manage and then derive value from that data that your systems are producing is really the challenge, right? It's the big challenge. And that's the role of analytics. You're going to have a data strategy and identify your data sources. And applying analytics once you've identified them is really where you're going to get value out of it. So I thought I'd cover just some high level areas of where users get value, right? The first one is in energy usage savings. And that's probably obvious and has been brought up a number of times. But I emphasize the word usage because the next one is energy cost savings. And interestingly enough, we see some users achieve energy cost savings while not reducing their energy usage, right? By looking at the data based on their tariff rates coming from the utility companies, looking at their usage profiles and their load profiles, sometimes they can get quick financial benefits before they really go to the next step and implement more advanced demand or usage reduction strategies, right? This is something that's not often understood at the onset by all organizations. Another thing we see is fast ROI. Implementing analytics doesn't mean we're going to connect to every piece of data and apply every possible rule and algorithm using every possible advanced technique. It means we have some data that we want to turn into some financial value. So we see organizations that look at their projects from that point of view, from the onset, can achieve very fast ROI, very often less than 1 year, right? One of the great examples we have seen like that is from an organization that started with just two pieces of readily available data, right? Which was their interval meter data coming from over 100 facilities, as well as their expected occupancy schedule coming from their lease agreements, right? So from that data, they're able to identify buildings that were not following schedules, equipment starting too early, running 24 hours a day. And they had payback on that investment in under 90 days, right? Which gave them additional credibility and financial resources to move further with their analytics journey. So other impacts that we see is increased efficiency of maintenance and repair operations. A simple example is, you know, a multi-site retailer was able to reduce their unplanned monthly truck rolls from 4 to 3. Well, with a large number of sites, that has a huge financial impact. Why? Well, because better information about what is needed was available when those trucks rolled. All right, so another thing we see is the reporting to support your ESG efforts, right? You have the ability to automatically and continuously calculate your key performance indicators so that they're always available. They can be delivered to other parts of the organization or outside organizations, including regulatory bodies. For example, in North America, reporting to Energy Star Portfolio Manager, right? It's a key benefit. One more benefit is with better data analytics, you can communicate more effectively with the financial team in their language with reports and presentations that fit the way that they want to evaluate projects. So what you're able to achieve is better understanding of your facilities, of your assets, of their performance, and that supports better decision-making. Yes, we have fault detection, and that will help us reduce our energy costs, but now we know where we should make the investments. We can track those results and we can prove those results compared to the expectations and prior performance of our facilities. All right, so those are the things that users can achieve with data and analytics. So at this point, data and analytics is widely proven across all different types of properties and asset classes. And there are numerous case studies available that illustrate these real-world benefits. With that, I think I'm out of time, and I'm going to hand it back over to Paul.
Thank you, Paul. This makes it easy, Paul and Paul.
Yeah.
So, Paul, a couple quick questions
sure.
Before we wrap up. One of the questions we find a lot of people ask is, what is the role of data semantics or data tagging in implementing analytics?
Yeah, it's a popular topic, and I know Ryan mentioned it earlier. You know, data needs to have meaning in order for the analytics to work effectively. In the IT world, this is sometimes referred to as data curation or data modeling. In building applications, we're talking about applying a consistent method of defining attributes, really, to the data produced using what we call tags, right? And an analytics solution requires that data to be tagged so that the meaning of the data can be understood by the software application. So one of the leading standards in this area, as Ryan mentioned, is Project Haystack, which is a worldwide open source initiative that has been developed, and they've developed standard tagging libraries and ontologies to apply to building system data.
Very good. And one other quick question. What is one of the most often overlooked elements of successfully applying analytics?
Well, it's a good question. And there's a few, but you know, analytics software finds issues, faults, trends, anomalies, deviations. But the value isn't in finding these issues. The value is really in addressing the issues once they're found, right? If I was to walk into your facility and identify 100 issues in your building, could you effectively respond to and address all of them, right? So having a plan to take those issues from the initial identification all the way through resolution is an important aspect that's often overlooked. Another one is really being able to effectively communicate the results, right, to all the different stakeholders within the facilities that are responsible for managing those facilities, right? So be able to have flexible views and apps and reports are essential features because all the different stakeholders, they all have very unique and different needs.
Very good. I have one more question. We still have another minute left. So understanding the analytics of energy and so forth and how that works and the fault detection on the mechanical systems and so forth, have you started to see a trend where you're starting to see integrated data sources outside of mechanical and energy management, such as we were talking briefly before about occupant utilization or indoor air quality? Are you starting to see that integrated into a software solution like yours?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. We have numerous partners throughout the world that are now bringing in, you know, occupancy data, IAQ data from external sources that, you know, live typically outside the building automation system or mechanical systems. Sometimes they're separate overlays. Sometimes they're sensors that are feeding up to some cloud layer. We're bringing that back in to give us a better understanding of the situation within the occupant environments. Absolutely. It's definitely a trend that's headed up currently, especially, you know, given the COVID situation clearly.
Mm-hmm. All right, Paul, very informative. And I want to thank you for presenting today. And what I'd like to do is bring everybody back for the panel discussion. I do have a question that I want to address first that is directed towards Rick. When you were talking about the, tracking people in the space and the spatial utilization, a question came up, are you tracking occupant phones? Are you using any type of technology to track occupant phones? And if so, are there any privacy issues that you had to address, like GDPR or PII?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Paul, or whoever asked it. No, we're just counting bodies. We cannot track anything that is presence or personal data for exactly the reason that the person asked, privacy reasons. We're not there. I think eventually, I hope we can, so we can also push customized services and information. If the building knows that a student is in the building and we know where the student needs to be, can we provide more customized supports and services? But today, we're just counting a class of 24. Is there 5 people in there or 24 people in there? And were they there from 11 till noon or not? Yeah, privacy is a huge, huge deal.
Very good. And your intention eventually is to integrate that data into your BMS platform as well?
Yeah, BMS and scheduling so that we can optimize the utilization as well as make sure that based on scheduling and real data that we can kind of prepare the space, heat the space, cool the space accordingly, and also turn off technologies. Most of our classrooms, increasingly going forward, there's lots of technology in those classrooms that otherwise is manually operated, that we can kind of turn things up and down based on real use. That's our vision going forward.
Okay, so now I'm going to start bringing out the questions, you know, to address the broader audience. So every one of you have been involved with trying to either bring a product into an IT infrastructure or as a owner operator of the systems, you have had to coordinate with the IT departments to bring these into your infrastructure. So Rick, since you're still on the mic, let's start with you. Talk a little bit about your journey and how the IT side of the house and the operations technology side of the house have joined hands and converged to be able to deliver these technologies. Because obviously you can't just plug something into a network and let it go. And if you can talk a little bit about that journey and some of the challenges you faced, and then I'm gonna go through the same question with other folks too.
Yeah, we're at the beginnings of really integrating the two. I mentioned earlier that we actually put facilities and IT now under one VP. Because of the dependencies, interdependencies, prior to that, they were actually not only reporting separately, but quite disconnected, to be honest. And that would mean we would have server closets without air conditioning in it, and I'm sure that's familiar to most. Or we would bring in all kinds of technology and then have a column or set the furniture up in the wrong direction and the screen would be behind, or the display for the digital screen would be in front of the whiteboard, on and on and on. So really bringing these together, we believe, will give us not only better use of space, but also start to think about what's the future of teaching and working look like. And it's not just the facilities or an IT conversation. Mm-hmm. I mentioned earlier also, having been on the side of a malware, I think it certainly made us very, it exposed the how many systems on the facility side are connected and dependent on technology, and how cyber, the way we do it on the user side and the IT side, needs to make it over into the OT side. As a matter of fact, we're working on a special series of courses and programs, credentials, with intelligent buildings to co-create learning at this intersection, because as we see more and more systems being connected and we experience this ourselves, we're going to need to have cyber incorporated in it. And then we think we have operational benefits from budgeting to planning to even our service desk. We had a 1-800 number for IT problems and a 1-800 number for facilities problems, and we think we can optimize all that as we now have structurally put these teams together.
Very interesting. Ryan, I'm going to go to you next. Same question.
Yeah, thank you. So this discussion of IT and operations is actually kind of deeply personal for me, because I started at Macerich in IT and slowly moved to the business side, which everyone kind of chuckles at. So at Macerich specifically, and especially where I sit, I keep my IT team incredibly close, and to the point that, you know, we put together these projects, building automation projects, CCTV projects, anything that has a technology spin, we actually hand off to IT to project manage and implement. We set the stage, we paint the target, and then they go build it out with the proper technology according to them, given our requirements. And that does a couple of things. It always makes sure that IT has that seat at the table that I personally think that they need, but also it really does allow for these solutions to be built from a cybersecurity privacy perspective, because they're not going to build something internally that they can't support. And then moving on past just the build phase, here at Macerich, we actually have people that are controls experts in-house that manage the controls infrastructure. We have CCTV experts in-house that manage that. So beyond just a traditional network engineer or servers or storage or anything like that, we have one or two specialized people that focus specifically on that, you know, so-called OT technology, because we really do believe that the bridge has to be there. So those people sit inside of IT, they're able to sit inside of those discussions with network engineers around concerns of security and able to kind of give the business stakeholders the proper feedback in terms of, hey, we can't do this because of X, or we can do this because of Y, or we have to do this because of whatever. So that's how we've approached it.
Very interesting. Shuli, you're going to be slightly different perspective, but again, how do you interact with the operations and IT teams? You're muted, I believe.
Okay.
That's better.
Great question, Paul. Thank you. And I appreciate what Ryan and Rick said previously. I also have a systems engineering background. And I remember years ago when people were first looking at technologies, whether it's IoT or central processing, we always said step away from the systems and figure out what you want to accomplish first. So we're going back to the original notion of what is the value of any informational place that is produced, performed, or designed? How do we measure the value of it? Then we go forward to those four key resources that I mentioned, the human resources, information and technology, which we think of as two separate entities now, and then place. How do we measure the value of all four resources, bringing them together for some sort of an experience, whether it is learning experience in higher education, producing, researching, et cetera. So I think that's really key. Once we start with that communication of looking at a balanced set of resources, and it marries both the physical and the digital, then we can start to look at a truly open, integrated workplace management solution. So yes, that's where I am today. But we can also start to understand that if we model place to achieve a certain result as measured by a certain set of factors and technologies that are providing that information, how does that, for example, affect maintenance? We can start to look at the values and the costs. If we, for example, model something in place, how does that affect the sustainability initiative that a client may have? So I think it harkens back to that original governance and policy and the notion of the value of all of these systems coming together, the information they produce, and then what is that result, and learning, prototyping and learning from that.
Very good. And Paul, same question for you.
Yeah, maybe a little different angle, but you know, probably one of the most significant things we've seen with our systems is really the requirement that they be brought back to the edge, right? And in the early days of building automation systems, you know, all the data was and all the controllers were home run back to a central IT closet and managed from one central location. Well, and kind of in, you know, as time went on, everything moved further and further out to the edge. So you had direct digital control systems. Same thing happened in kind of the analytics evolution. Initially, everything was offered as a cloud solution where the data would leave the building, which, you know, caused its own security challenges. Streaming open protocols that aren't secure over the internet sometimes isn't the best idea for your facility. And so what we've seen is the requirement to have that data brought in-house. And so the analytics can reside at the edge, right? So the data can be collected, analyzed, and the results produced at the edge while still working as part of an overall system. But that way it can be managed by the internal IT teams and they don't have to lose control of the data and being able to maintain it over the year. So that's probably the most significant thing we're seeing is really the distribution of analytic system. But I think the important point about that is there is no singular best solution, right? Architectures need to be flexible to fit the unique needs and specific requirements of every IT and every enterprise. So that they can have in the system that they require and that they feel comfortable maintaining, you know, over the long haul.
Very good. Thank you for that perspective. So, Rick, right.
Just real quick, Paul, if I could, I just would like to piggyback off of Paul's comment there about bringing the data in-house. An interesting note, the Danbury project that I highlighted, where we are actually leveraging his product SkySpark to do that automated demand limiting and data analytics. A part of the requirement of that project that the system integrator gave us was to put that instance inside of our building. So we actually spun up a server physically at the site that runs the SkySpark to maintain best practices and controls of keeping the logic, the if this then that, as close to the edge as possible, which was actually wildly different than the rest of our fault detection diagnostic architecture, which is hosted. So right. Definitely what Paul is saying is a trend that we're seeing.
I see both. There's different ways, different thinking. Obviously IoT devices, most of them are cloud-based, they're not on-prem solutions. So that presents unique challenges. So I want to go back to something that Rick brought up. It was very interesting. A couple of things to bring up here. One is from the operations side and design side of a smart technology project, when you want to implement a project and go through the design and discovery of the technologies and so forth. I found it very interesting, the specification section that showed web browsers that aren't even here anymore. It shows equipment that was obsoleted and software platforms that were obsoleted years ago. So how does your organization handle the product life cycle and software life cycle? Typically, you know, IT organizations, it's like a 5-year plan, you know, for end of life and shelving it and moving it on. Are you finding that your campus is starting to understand that and adapt to that change? The same thing with the technology as well, and bringing your systems up to that level to make sure that they are secure. As you mentioned, the remote access was an issue, and we hear every day of different systems getting hacked and the vulnerabilities because there aren't key things in place, change management processes, security patching, disaster recovery plans, and so forth. So if you could provide a little input on that, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, I'll try, because the reality is, we recognize that there's a can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello? Yeah. Oh, sorry. We recognize there's a discrepancy in terms of life cycle between the facilities team and the IT team. I think we did not have kind of a very clear audit, like a systems lens. I think bringing together our facilities and IT is helpful. I think we've recognized we need a smart building specialist on our team that can marry the two conversations and bridge between the two worlds. Mm-hmm. I know there is some training and cross-training that may be possible, but again, as I mentioned, even when on the capital project, we hire engineers and consultants and architects, and we still get some of that language. We think that the people maybe around us also still need some of that guidance. So as an owner of 2 million square feet, I think it's on us to own this conversation and to drive this and not just to depend and rely on others. So we will be investing in resources that be right at that connection between the two and start to look at how we think about systems and life cycle renewal of smart building technologies. I think we are early there. We have a lot of work to do there. So if you ask how we've done it and how successful we've been, I can't answer that because we're not there. And I would be ashamed in one hand saying that, but I'm thinking probably 90% or 95% of building owners aren't there. I don't think
I am going to send a loaded question to you. Don't take it the wrong way. But do you have your own specifications in-house on your campus, or do you rely on the engineering and consulting firms to provide that?
Well, the latter. Yeah, we rely on engineers. We don't have that. And we're not in the business of that. We're in the business of education. Right. So one of the discussions we're having, of course, also is how much of this do we need to do in-house and how much do we need to do this with partners?
My next question is, do you have a Division 25 spec for the integration, the master system integration for all these technologies?
For all of our buildings? If you mean for everything we do?
Before you can apply to your campus.
Not the standard one yet, no.
Okay.
This is why we early stage in engaged intelligent buildings, because I think we recognized we do need a specialist at the table. The same way we hire mechanical engineers and electrical engineers and architects, especially we surround ourselves by specialists. This is an area of expertise that we need to treat the same and get a specialist at the table.
Very good. Ryan, I'm going to ask the same question.
So in terms of life cycle, we are still young in that discussion. I can tell you that I've been in discussions, you know, kind of as an internal champion with my IT team in terms of, you know, turnover and necessary upgrades. It's a challenge for any, you know, real estate owner because, you know, they're used to, you know, investments that last 10, 15, 20 years. The, you know, argument that I try to make from my seat at the table is, hey, how old's your phone, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how old's your computer? These things are computers, guys. Like, let's stop thinking about these in terms of, you know, mechanical assets or roofs that have a 15-year life cycle. These things have a 5-year, 3-year life cycle, and that's okay. If we want to continue to maintain our competitive edge in terms of customer and tenant engagement, we have to accept a shorter lifespan. That's sometimes gotten traction, sometimes not. Really kind of depends on the, you know, leasing environment and whatever headwinds the company is seeing. In terms of your follow-on question, we do rely on design consultants whenever we do construction, large construction jobs. For capital projects, we do a lot of that internally. We have, I think, a pretty mature design intent criteria for Division 25, but every building is different, every project is different. So we do hire engineers to write out the specifics of a Division 25 based on the requirements of that specific project, based on our design intent criteria. So we're kind of middle of the road. We're definitely not an engineering or an A&E firm. We definitely want to have the experts be the experts, but we definitely try to narrow the field a little bit to be more specific to what we, our use case and what we're specifically looking for. And frankly, more often than not, to Rick's point, the things we don't want, right? We don't want a proprietary system, right? And, you know, if you get an A&E that has, you know, a buddy who works for Honeywell, you have to pay very close attention to that, you know, specification. No shade at Honeywell, just using that as an example. So we try to find those independent, you know, people like Logical Buildings that can translate our design intent criteria into a sophisticated Division 25.
Very good. So we did have a question from the panelist. Question is, will evaluation programs like SPIRE and Smart Score and Building Intelligent Quotient help educate the market? Ryan, while you're on the mic.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I kind of view these very similar to LEED. And I think that's what they're trying to do. And I find them to be incredibly interesting, very young in a lot of respects. Will it help educate the market? I think we have to ask, did LEED help educate the market? Did it move the conversation in terms of sustainable design, or was it a check the box kind of situation? I think the jury's still out on that. I think it's very interesting. I like the direction that it's going, but my question is, who's the audience for that score? You know, if you're already a building owner that's going down that path, you know, is it interesting to compare your buildings? Sure. But do you already kind of know which buildings need some love in the smart building space and which don't? Probably, if you're paying attention. So, again, I think the jury's still out, but I think it's very interesting.
Can I add to this, Paul, please?
Yes, Rick, you're asking you as well.
Yep. Being in an education institution, we ponder about this a lot. I think the world of smart building is here and here to stay, but yet why still don't we see it enough? And knowing RealCom has been talking about this for decades, and there's this group that understands this, but there's a much larger group out there that hasn't. I think part of it is actually education systems. We have students coming to engineering class and production school, and they don't learn this stuff by and large. I think we're into slowly tweaking this into our curriculum. If you really look at, there's no really programs out there about smart building experts per se. It's still too much on the facility side or the IT side, but not really married. Then I think there's continuing education and continuing education credits. I think there's associations and groups like RealCon trying to do this, but I think there has to be a much more diligent approach towards delivering continuing education for professionals in the marketplace. And then I do believe, you know, evaluation programs will help. I think Ryan's comment around leads. Lead did move a market, but was that because of the marketing and the buzz, or was that because of what it really was? And now I think there's lots of people looking at lead and say, well, but it's time, moment in time, and it has had to evolve. So I think we need all of it to move a market, but it has surprised me how slow has been, unfortunately.
And I think we can all agree, I agree with you 100% on your comment about education. It's not only at the higher ed level educating, it's also the consulting firms and, you know, other folks that are involved in the industry bringing that education where it starts at the developers, the architects, and then it rolls down to the MEP firms or and so forth, bringing that out. As you said earlier, your specifications, you're still seeing things that are from 15 years ago, which shouldn't even be in the specifications anymore. And it's hard to move that needle if the technology component is not in the specifications and the education is not there when they integrate that into building design. You look in North America at the buildings, there's just starting to be the trend where that technology is rolling out. You look over in the Middle East, in areas in Dubai and so forth, that technology's been there for years. And Asia Pacific, a lot of areas as well. So why is it so slow to adapt here? They're more proactive with the technology. They're more proactive because the density of the population, you know, especially, you know, in the COVID scenario now with the track, you know, the spatial utilization and tracking of occupants and contactless entry into facilities. There's a lot of technologies out there that help support things. And I think COVID was a really big eye-opener for everybody and how it's going to impact real estate, how it's going to impact education, and every other vertical out there in bringing in technology now to manage things. So I haven't seen any more questions come in, so I'm going to ask another question. And this is going to be for everybody, and I'm going to start with Julie and Paul after that, and then your team. Bringing all this technology is great, but how do you get that technology rolled out where it's actionable, where people can interact with that technology? So one of the things, obviously, we see a lot of buzz about apps being developed and vendors are providing apps for certain things, but it's great for the product. But then how does it interface in with other systems that you bring in, other technologies you bring in? So, Shuli, I know, let's talk on a plan-on perspective and app development for an end user to be able to do that, and how does that roll out?
Yeah, great question, Paul. Thank you. And actually, my response is not only to that question, but some of the previous conversations. In higher education in particular, which is my background, it's very much been a push versus pull scenario in the past. The individual departments, the academic schools, et cetera, will push a need, whether it's to purchasing or IT, of a particular product or solution that they need to bring in-house to create sort of that digital textbook environment. And what we're seeing now is a flipped model of that, where the IT departments, the technology departments on campuses are becoming more informed about the possibilities. And they are now starting to go out and inform the individual schools or divisions or departments, excuse me, on what the options are. And what that does is two things. One is it advances the requests when the institutions do go to RFP letting and releasing requests, because they're asking for more advanced technologies because they're more informed. But it also is allowing IT technology departments to, and facilities as well, to start to look at what they can create in more of a matrix environment. What solutions can we inform or offer to multiple departments rather than looking at that siloed division by division? So I think the greatest trend then is that shift from the push to IT and facilities and saying we need more space and we need this in it to do these things, to IT then taking the lead and informing the institutions of what those possibilities are. And they're also helping on the security side, because as they start to do more research and talk to the experts in these different areas, they can also understand better methods of securing the information, of dispersing the information, and ensuring that in the remote settings and in the online settings, that the information is valid and secure.
You're on mute. Paul, I think you're on mute.
Yep, sorry. Paul, to you.
Same question? Yeah, so, yes. And you know, I know this is educational. I can only really speak to that in terms of our product platform. So I think one of the, most important things is that the platform be, you know, extensible, right? Our platform specifically is able to be extended by the end users themselves or by system integrators that are implementing these for customers, which means using point and click methodologies, they can build their own applications. So the data can be easily, you know, you can easily get data in from a variety of sources external to the system, as well as the ability to get data out to other external systems or build your own apps within our system, right? So it's very flexible in terms of extending it to provide the functionality that is needed by the particular user to solve their particular case. Does that get out at the question?
Sure thing.
All right.
Sounds great. So I'm going to swing into a new topic here that applies to everyone. So we're talking a lot about data. We're talking about data tagging, normalization, different things here. So my question is to everyone here, what are some of your planning phases for housing this data? Because if we start bringing all this data in, all this technology, it's not going to be able to be hosted on a single server anymore, especially if you're in an integrated campus or a corporation with multiple facilities and square footage to manage. You start to get more into a micro enterprise type of environment. So what are some of the things that you're talking about with clients that you work with or internally within your organization on how you're going to manage your data and the data policies and housing that data and retention of that data? How long are you going to hold on to it? So Ryan, Rick, either one, we're going to go through everybody.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I may not be the ultimate expert on this. Our move is to the cloud. Again, I think what we've seen with the cyber challenge we've had this summer, the more we can rely on either hybrid cloud or cloud environment, the better it would be for us. Maybe we, again, care less unless it meets certain expectations, and you called it out, privacy. And when we look at contracts we're signing now, it's all about how we deal with privacy and cybersecurity, that we are very strict and have high expectations around the security of the data and where the work, how the workloads are being treated. So I think we're going to see, due to COVID, a transition or transformation of how we think about where data sits and who owns the data, but driven by cyber and privacy, where we want to lead with the policies.
Very good. Ryan, next.
Yeah, please. I think it's a multifaceted discussion. I think, you know, kind of in a very high level general sense, we're looking at a hybrid cloud kind of solution. I think that kind of meets most of our requirements, but I also think it's very solution specific. Something like CCTV, you know, we want to keep locally there with server and storage, but something like, you know, automated demand management, that can be offloaded to a third party cloud hosted. So I think, you know, the flexibility in your base infrastructure to allow to build where you need to build and to offload where you should offload is key.
Very good. And Shuli, from a different perspective.
Thank you, Paul. PlanOn offers multiple very large scale universal cloud-based solutions for our SaaS modules and components. And we look at three critical areas. One is the security of our clients' information. We look at authority, who has the rights and the abilities to look at information. And then service level agreements, ensuring that wherever somebody is, they have access to the integrated open platform so that they can work with all of the information that they need to make decisions within their purview.
Very good. And Paul, I'm going to go to you, same question. I know you mentioned earlier about on-prem solutions, but does Sky Foundry also offer a cloud-hosted solution?
So we do not offer a cloud-hosted solution. We don't get involved in the projects. So that's all done by our partners worldwide. But we really see it as a distributed computing challenge, right? The IoT is a distributed computing challenge. Not every sensor value you have throughout your facilities needs to be streamed up to a cloud and or a central server in order to gain value from it. A lot of that value can happen right where that piece of data is collected and then aggregated, right? Do I need every change of value from that temperature sensor, or do I really need to just need to know what the average was over the last hour, right? So you can make the decision at the edge and still get the aggregate value up to central location for access and historical records and, you know, a central point in that point at that part. So we see both, right? There is no one size solution, and we see this combination of cloud and at the edge is critical, you know, and it's probably an overused example, but, you know, a smart driving car ripping down the street, a kid runs out in front of the car, you know, what do you want to have happen? Well, you want that car to stop, right? And then you don't want that car to have to, you know, connect to the cloud in order to make the decision to stop, but you do want that information coming from the car so that it can aggregate the thousands or millions of times that's happened, so it can improve the results and the algorithms over time and push those back to the edge so that that decision could be made even better and faster at the edge, right? So this combination to really solve the what is actually a distributed computing challenge.
Okay, I have one more question from the audience. I know we're getting close to wrapping this up, and I think Ryan, this one I'll direct to you. The question is, how does this data acquisition help the real estate industry report to GRE, SBI, as they need to report on mitigation of fossil fuels and GHG reductions, especially for valuation of the real estate?
So that's GRESB benchmarking, right? Which is kind of what, you know, my industry uses as their benchmark, because most of our assets can't use ENERGY STAR. It's absolutely critical, right? I will tell you very plainly and honestly that one of the reasons why Macerich has been so successful in, you know, our benchmarking and our peers in industry and how we compare to our peers is our data collection strategy. The fact that we tap all of our meters, we clean our data, we pay attention to these very at times unsexy details and projects. Having a clean, robust data set allows us to report more accurately, allows us to report more robustly, and gives us the ability to attack those areas that need to be attacked when they need to be attacked. So for instance, during my presentation, we installed solar. Great. Hey, we did it, guys. Congratulations. Oh, wait, we actually shifted all of our load to, you know, 4 to 6 p.m. because we're open till 10 p.m. Now we have a new thing to attack, right? And that's we only see that through our robust data acquisition and benchmarking policies and practices that internally.
Right. Very good. So I know our time's up. I want to thank everybody on the panel. It's been a great conversation. And Sarah, back to you.
Thank you so much, Paul, for moderating. And thanks to all the panelists for joining us. Really appreciate you sharing your insights with the community and providing your presentations. Thank you very much. I do want to invite the audience to join us for our next webinars. We actually have two webinars coming up next week. We are doing part three of the Smart Building Showcase series, talking about smart districts. And then we will also be talking about flexible hybrid workplace models. So those are coming up next week. And with that, I'd like to wish everyone a wonderful rest of your day. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye, everyone.